Good morning, everybody. My name is Vince. This is Jeff wheeling his way through the crowd here. You all know me. I like to learn things. I'm not really fussy about what I learn. I can learn pretty much anything. And I like to learn about you people. So the surveys you get on a regular basis, yeah, that's from me, because I want to learn about you. Figure out what's working, what's not working, like what we need to keep doing, what we need to do more of, what stuff we need to stop. So today I want to share with you a few numbers that we learned about in the last couple weeks. Last year we raised money for a project in Rio Azul, and we built a second sanitation tank to remove sewage from their yards. This is a little town in rural Guatemala, and the town is just poor, like dirt poor. And so we went in there and we helped them do something that they've never even seen in this area before, to actually process their sewage and separate it out and then send it someplace that can be taken care of in a safe way. For all those you know in third world countries, how do you do it? You dump your sewage into the river and then the next person deals with it, right? Delicious drinking water. So this was incredible. Last year, we raised $28,000 from 68 people in our community. Isn't that incredible? $28,000. And the money's sitting, waiting for a few things to happen in third world countries. Things don't go as smooth as you always like them to. It's not like Canada where you have a contract and then everything goes smooth from that point on. We're doing a little bit of work, but it's all there, ready, waiting. We went and saw the first water tank. We saw the place for the second water tank, or the sanitation tank. It's looking amazing. And that's why this week, as we went through, or the last couple weeks as we went through, we've been talking to you guys about Veggie School. That's the next phase in the Rio Azul story. It's basically teaching a community to live in a way that's completely different from their culture, in a way that's healthy long term. And it's a great project. I've been there. I've seen the difference that healthy food makes. So as of Friday this week, we'd raised a little over $10,000. And only about half of you donated to it. And I don't say that in any way to shame you at all. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is, when I look at numbers, which I look at numbers all the time, I went, whoa, something happened there. Something that I didn't see coming. I think what we spent some time talking, what do we spend some time talking to you guys? And we realize you guys are water carriers. We hear stories all around. I'll tell you one in a few minutes. Stories of people, you guys taking water, finding a need in your life and doing something to make it better. So you guys are water carriers. Me and Jeff have been there. We've seen this project. We know it's awesome. But I think we didn't communicate what you guys needed to be who you are, to be water carriers. So I think what we learned through this process is we kind of assume that you know everything that we know. And so we didn't tell you a whole lot. We're like, hey, Veggie School, give her.
Yeah,
talk amongst yourselves.
Sorry.
In the past years, we exerted a lot more. I think we came to realize we exerted a lot more effort in being able to help our community understand the difference between relief work and development work. We spent a lot of time in past years explaining that and really the beauty of the Rio Azul project. For those of you maybe that aren't even, when I say those two things, maybe there's not really an easy differentiation in your mind. Relief work really is that quick, sudden burst of help. Think about air bombing in and dropping rice and blankets and tents for refugees that are on the run for their lives and have nothing. When you drop that kind of relief work, it provides relief instantaneously. People are sleeping in a warm bed with food in their stomach, having gone without for who knows how many days just before that. Relief work is quick, and the other thing about it is it's instantly gratifying for those that are offering that kind of help. You see the people reaching out, they eat it, they go, oh, wow, thank you, they're warm. Development work is different. So relief work offers short-term solutions, short-term fixes for a very immediate critical need. Long-term solutions, and really the work of development work, focuses long-term, says, okay, that's fine for today. They got blankets and they got rice, but where are these people going to settle long-term? Where are they going to get their water? How are we going to educate them? How are they going to build a new life in this new way of normal that they're going to have to find? Development work is very long-term, and it's messy. It's complicated, and it's not sexy. Over the last 30 years, they figure most money being given from the developed world to developing countries has been given to relief organizations that are providing short-term fixes to problems. Books have been written, research has been done to the point where they're saying, actually, we're hurting more than we're helping by providing most of our help in this relief way. We got to shift our mindset to become development oriented, where we got to help build new realities for these people so they can prevail long term. Long term work is not sexy. Long after the hype that got swirling around Haiti and remember the earthquakes that happened, long after that, they were left with the real mess. The celebrities went home, and so did the money. Haiti is left destitute. We watched this again and again, and we determined years ago we were going to be different in our approach to being able to help make our world better. We were going to approach it through a development mindset. That was Rio Azul. There's a lot to know about Rio Azul and the unique approach we're taking there, the veggie school that we're doing here. But over the last few weeks, as we've been poking around going, hey, where's everyone at with this? We've been noticing that many of the questions poking up are coming through very much a relief mindset. It's like, geez, this is not going to be quick. Like, you're going to teach them how to grow vegetables? How long does a crop take? Are these people starving? Like, isn't there better projects out there that we can be devoting our money to? So this kind of thinking is very relief-oriented. It's not development-oriented. So we just said, you know what we got to do? We got to back up, and we got to take the time to educate our community so that we understand why we're doing Rio Azul and why we're doing Veggie School and why we're committing to something that maybe doesn't seem as sexy as some other projects you've heard about. But why, in the long run, we believe this thing is incredibly important. So that's what we're going to do over the next few weeks. Let me just say in the meantime, many of you have given. There's a number of people in our community that understand why we're doing Food for the Hungry, Rio Azul development work. You get it, and because of that, you've given. Some of you have given generously without knowing why. Some of you are going, really? Oh, I didn't know that. That's what I was giving to. Oh, great. But you gave because you trusted us. You're going, well, they seem pretty pumped on it. So, hey, we'll fork out the money. Appreciate it. Really appreciate it. But we're betting that there's some people that have been sitting on the sidelines just going, not all of this is adding up. And we want to help make sure that you understand why. And in fact, we're grateful because we need discerning people, too, who are not just going to throw their money anywhere, but are really thinking this through. Now, we're hoping as we tell all the ins and outs of the why, we're hoping anyways, some of you that have been sitting on the sidelines will jump in. We're hoping. And let me say one last thing. For those of you here who are already involved in a number of other projects, and you're going, hey, this sounds great, this is awesome, but I'm already invested in some of the... We get it. Mm-hmm. And we're not trying to obligate everyone to do this. We know that there are many great causes to be involved in. All right? So, that's the deal on Rio Azul. That's where we're going with this thing. We're just going to pull back a little bit. We're going to make sure everyone's on the same page so that when someone asks you about it, you're able to say, yeah, I get why we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And here's a little bit maybe that you need to know. All
Perfect.
Right? Cool. Vince, take it away.
So, do you remember a time in your life where you have a story, but the audience you're telling the story to, you're kind of shifting it a little bit? Think telling the crazy story you had with your buddies to your, you know, 80-year-old grandmother. You kind of edit out a few of the details, right? You soften the language a little bit. That the cliff wasn't 20 feet. It was only about 4 feet. You don't want to give grandma a heart attack. I didn't say the F-bomb as I flew over the edge. I said, oh, shoot. Come on, you're all thinking this. You all have stories in your mind, right? I had a buddy who, whenever his mom told me a story about him, I knew I needed to go ask him. She'd be like, oh, he took the car out this week and we were gone and the tire was stolen. Next day at school, I'm like, so what'd you do with the tire? Well, I ran into a thing. I tried to steal another thing. Then I did this. So I told my mom the story about how, you know, someone stole the tire. It's funny how we do this, isn't it? I told my dad a story one time. At the end of the story, I can see his face is all dark. And I'm like, this is Vincent. When I'm in trouble, they call me Vincent. Vincent, we didn't teach you that word. And I was like, which word? So we had this really awkward 5-minute conversation where I was trying to figure out which swear word I said. And then, you know, but I'm trying not to say them again, to offend them again. So I'm like, is it the one that rhymes with truck? You know? I've learned now when I talk to my dad, I'm supposed to say, I was angry. Because the other way of saying it really offends him. And I won't say it for you guys just in case I offend you. You see, I'm doing it already, right? I'm saying things a little bit differently for you guys than for everyone else. And the reason I talk about this is because I think we do this in the church. Friend church is probably a little bit better, but I think we still do it. How we are in our lives out there and how we are in here subtly shifts. You know, when something heavy drops on my toe in my shop, I say one thing. When something heavy drops on my toe here, do I say the same thing? Do we dress the same way, act the same way? So I decided I wanted to do something. I wanted you guys to get in touch with this feeling. And so I recruited some help. For all those who have kids downstairs at the Kids at Friends Church. You all know Jody. You've all heard of Video Time with Jody. The infamous Video Time with Jody. Jody's our kids pastor who, in the nicest possible way, Jody, is a little crazy and does awesome stuff. She seems to have no shame. So she makes these incredible videos that are the lessons for the kids. And they're hysterical. They're funny enough that some families on a Friday night will put a laptop on the table and sit around as a family watching her videos and laughing. When's the last time your kids asked to watch a curriculum from church? When Jody's at the helm, they do. So if you want to check it out, she has an entire YouTube channel now for Video Time with Jody. And so I asked her, I said, I want you just to explore this concept of how we do things in a regular world and how we do things at church. Can you just play the first clip for me, Corey?
I'm 264, my love, 264, my love, love's going to leave.
Okay, who's heard that saying? You know, I'm going to get struck by lightning for doing that in church. Who is scared for my health right now? Laura's in the back saying, yeah, you're going to get it. But it's true, right? There's a piece of even watching that. There's this, are you allowed to do that in church? Can you show videos like that in church? We act differently. We dress differently. We talk differently. So why do we act differently here than the rest of the world? That's what I want to talk about today. Sure, some of it's social pressure, but where did the social pressure come from? I was asking a bunch of people this week, and they would say things like, because it's church. Or, well, Vince, you just can't do that in church. And then if I pushed a little bit and said, no, go deeper than that. You kind of see them kind of go, well, church is sacred. I was out with my run group the other day, and some guy pipes up in the back. He says, it's because God's more in the church than in the rest of the world. And we all had this kind of sobering moment that we kind of act that way, don't we? Now, some of you believe in a very imminent God, where God is kind of like right here and not right there, and that's cool. That's not what I'm getting at today. But for me, a God that's more than kind of has... there's not a physical location. God's everywhere. That's kind of how I see it or how I believe it. But then I started to ask the question, if God's a little bit more in church, should we be acting differently? Now, this isn't a new idea in church. This is something we've been doing actually for thousands of years. But before I do that, I just want to share one quick story. Can I share you guys a water story? Sorry, I'm going to rabbit trail here for a second. My ADD kicked in and boom, over here. I always like to tell you guys about different things that are going on in our community, different ways people take water. And this one, after me and Jeff talked about Veggie School, I don't want it to be connected to Veggie School, but it is. There's a group of people in our community who crochet, like kids' booties, with like these super fly suede soles. And I get an email last week saying, hey Vince, what's that whole thing about Guatemala business? So I told her, and she's like, you know what? I think I want to sell my crocheting stuff and raise money for Guatemala. It's so amazing how when I look across the face of this community, I see all the different ways people take water. From a lemonade stand last year to somebody who put up money for a social media challenge, people who give to things that I don't even hear about. Isn't this an amazing community of people passionate about taking what they have and using it as water to make this world a better place? Sorry, that just gets me all fired up. So I just wanted to tell you about it. Kind of an awkward transition, wasn't it? I'm good at those. So, I want you to imagine you're on a warm Mediterranean summer day. You're walking down the roads of what is now modern-day Turkey, chatting with a few friends, enjoying the shade of the trees overhead, but there's no wind. It's just stifling hot. When suddenly the palm trees overhead start to rustle, but you don't feel any wind. And then the tree trunks start to sway. You can feel it in your feet through your sandals. It's like a vibration. It's like a hum. There's no carts passing by, and that wouldn't make sense anyways. It doesn't feel like that. It feels deeper than that. Vibrations are going deeper inside. In fact, the stones beneath your feet start to vibrate, and they start to move. You can actually see them moving in front of you. To the point where you can't even stand up. You fall down. You feel the stones hit your knees. And now above the sounds you hear a deeper vibration sound that's coming through your bones. You can't even hardly hear it, but you can feel it. It's like the whole world is vibrating. Your teeth are, you can feel them chattering together. Vibration moves into your ears. You know when you put a shell up to your ear, that sound? It starts off like that. It gets louder and louder and louder and louder until it's so loud it's taking over everything. You can't even hear yourself talk. And then the sound grows louder than that until all sound is consumed except for the screams of people as a tsunami wave hits you. This happened just beside the Aegean Sea in what's modern-day Turkey. A tsunami wave hit the land. Thousands and thousands of people died. And I tell you this not because I love history, which I don't really love to rewrite or redo history, but I tell you because this is a pivotal moment in church history. Because something happened in the church because of that moment, because of the tsunami that happened in that time. And before I can explain why it's important, let me go back to one more story. And Jeff told this 2 weeks ago. Remember he told that story about the cave woman 10,000 years ago? She started to realize that there's forces kind of out there that had a lot of influence on her life. In fact, they could control whether her family lived or died. The forces could control her little food plant her family needed to live. They could send the animals far away so their partner couldn't get meat at the hunt. They could make her monthly cycle relatively painless or excruciating. They could make her child sick or healthy. And these forces had all the power and were completely capricious in what they chose to do. You had no clue what they were going to do from one day to the next, from one minute to the next. One day, the food tree got everything it needed, grew up big, great, lots of stuff to eat. Next day, one day the hunt was good, next day it's not. One day, their child has a sniffle. If the forces are happy, it goes away. If the forces are angry, it goes bad. These forces were all powerful, and you never knew what they were going to do. But the impact of these forces was life-threatening. Imagine that, your life or death depending on the whims of forces you can't even see. You can't talk to, you don't know why they're angry or why they're happy, why they hurt you one day and save you the next. It's like your entire life is based on a roll of a dice or a flip of a coin. Heads, you're done. Tails, you get everything you need. Talk about crushing fear. Wouldn't have been? Every morning you wake up and go, are they angry? Are they happy? Over time, the people started to name the forces. They called them gods. Jeff shared about that 2 weeks ago. Names like Gula, the god of healing, or Ishtar, the god of fertility. Marduk, the god of thunder, and Ra, the sun god of Egypt. So on and so on. And here's the fascinating time for the evolution of the philosophy of religion. Because it seems that the cave people and their descendants started to think they saw patterns in how the gods acted. One day someone leaves some food out. The next day the hunt goes well. Can't you just see the urban myth starting? Wait a second. If we leave out food, then maybe they'll be happy. If we do this, then maybe do that. And maybe we can get some level of control over these forces that are just wreaking havoc in our lives. And they started to create these urban myths around what's going to make the god angry and what's going to make the gods happy. What's going to make them bless us and what's going to make them hurt us. It was a major shift in the philosophy of religion. So take that story and take it back to modern day Turkey. I told you the story about the tsunami hitting them. These people have no clue what creates a tsunami. This is like 700 AD. They don't realize that something on the earth or the sea floor, we think it's a volcano caused by the movement of the tectonic plates, blah, blah, blah. That stuff hasn't been created for another probably 60 generations, even the theory of it. So these pre-modern people look at a tsunami that kills that many people and go, what? The gods must be angry. Now this has evolved a little bit further. So in their minds, they're going to say, God is angry. And then they come to the most important question. Why? Why is God angry at us? Just feel that. If we don't get this right, this is going to happen again. It's at that time that the emperor of the area, his name's Leo III, well, at least that's the name he took, he decided that he thought the reason God was angry was because of where they were seeing God in the world. They weren't like us where, you know, you talk differently outside of church, you talk differently inside of church. That's not really how it went for them. For them, it was seemed to be focused around images and icons. You see, churches and holy sites around the country had icons or images of Jesus. Can you put that one up? This isn't actually from the time. You'll understand why in a second. Or the Trinity. This is my favorite one. See the three mouths, three nose, four eyes? This is a classic view of the Trinity. Or even the Mother, the Mary of God, called Theotokos, meaning God-bearer. These were the things that they journeyed to go see. And think about it. They're not close by. You can't just whip out your phone and be like, okay, Trinity image, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right there. You know, sitting at McDonald's and I'm surfing this stuff, right? they would have had to walk sometimes weeks. Imagine that, walking 2 weeks to go see an icon of Jesus. Tell me, that wouldn't have been a profound experience. Not to mention the exhaustion, all this stuff. You're not used to seeing imagery. This isn't part of your everyday life. You don't have Google Images that you can look up anything anywhere you want. They would walk to these sacred locations and see this image. And it seems that something happened for them there. Things changed. They seem to see God in those icons. God is more where these icons are than where I live. God is more where these images are than where I go to work. And so because of the tsunami, some say, Emperor Leo III destroyed a huge number of icons during the time from 726 to 730 AD, what we call the first iconoclasm age. Just so you know, iconoclasm will be the word of the day. I'll suggest you use it. Try and use it 3 times today. Try and use that while ordering at McDonald's. If you got a good one, send it to me. I'd like to hear it. It's amazing. During that year, the number of relics that were destroyed, icons that were destroyed, is innumerable. In fact, we now have relics about the burning of the relics. But we don't have a whole lot from this era. Fast forward a little while, relics came back into the church. Like anything, things ebbed and flow. All of a sudden it was like, well, we destroyed all the relics. Things aren't going perfect. Maybe it wasn't the relics. Relics came back into the church. Icons came back in. We started having imagery. Fast forward another few years, Emperor Leo V, same time, or sorry, a couple years later, but from the same area. He's doing a little research one day in his castle, I'm guessing, palace. And he says this, all the emperors who took up the images and venerated them met their death either in revolt or in war. But those who did not venerate images all died a natural death. They remained in power until they died and were laid to rest with honors. See how the urban myths get made? Emperor Leo V goes, wait a second. Just like that woman who said, when I put out food, the hunt went better next day. Maybe the gods like food. Emperor Leo V goes, wait a second. Maybe we don't venerate imagery. Maybe then God won't be mad. And just so you know, veneration will be your second word of the day. Also an excellent word. The second iconoclasm age went from 814 to 842. Where the Eastern Church destroyed most of their iconography, which for a pre-literate culture was a huge piece. Think mass book burnings in our day and age. This is a big piece. And you'd think we'd be done. You'd think at some point people would go, well, wait a second, this didn't fix everything. Maybe the icons aren't the problem. I want you to fast forward to 1517. Luther, a Catholic priest, gets all his knickers in the knot with the Catholic Church, blows up. We go from the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church to the Catholic Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, and the Protestant Church. One of the main people in the Protestant Church is a guy by the name of John Calvin. Now there's others, Karl Stadt, Zwingli, all the big guns from that area. But they got back onto this bandwagon saying, wait a second, images aren't good. We're not supposed to venerate them like that. Calvin says, we believe it wrong that God should be represented by a visible appearance because he himself has forbidden it. And it cannot be done without defacing his glory. This isn't artistic issues. It's not like we had a generation of bad artists. This is a theological issue. What does he say? Because God forbid it. Can you guess where he forbid it? In the Ten Commandments. You're all wondering when I was going to get to the Ten Commandments, right? Since we're in the middle of a Ten Commandments series. It's interesting, isn't it? He reads this line from Ten Commandments. You must not make for yourself an idol. And says, God, guys, no more images. You must not make an idol of for yourself of any kind. Now, the first readers of this, we know, or we surmise, they didn't quite get this whole no idol thing, because the author has to write a few more. Don't make an idol of any kind or an image of anything in heavens or on earth or in the sea. You must bow down to anything or worship them. It's kind of like, guys, come on, like seriously. But Calvin and the Protestant Reformation take this seriously. Deadly seriously. So the question I want to ask today, what is an idol? Because I spent time looking through iconoclasm and all the different things we've talked about. Spent time looking through original documents, looking at our culture. What does it mean to have an idol? I can whip up my phone at any time and take a picture of anything. That's not an idol. Last weekend I was in Manitoba. I ate from one side of my dad's small town to the other side. I wanted to eat that place dry, like no food left. I took a picture of every meal. I understand that the meal that on my phone is not the meal. It's just a picture. It helps me remember, right? We don't see images as idols. So what's an idol for us? How does this even work? Then I was reading a commentary by the Jewish Publication Society. If you ever want to read a really great commentary, they're hard to get, but fascinating. The commentator said this, "In the Israelite view, any symbolic representation of God must necessarily be both inadequate and a distortion." Okay, we heard Calvin say that. "For an image becomes identified with what it represents and is soon looked upon as the place and the presence of the deity." Get it? That's where the deity is. Another guy, the guy's name is Bernhard. "Such images or idols were used throughout the ancient Near East as a means of suggesting the presence of the deity. Not as objects of worship. They didn't worship the idol. It's that's where God was. God, an idol made God feel close with us. Because we could see it. It's over there, right on the shelf by the plant, you know, right there. God's right there. And that feels nice, doesn't it? God's close. There's a feeling of imminence to that. God's with us. Doesn't that seem to be what we've done in the church? God is here more than out there. I'm not saying all the time, but there's subtle pieces that have influenced how we behave and how we act. Because God is here more than out there. And that wouldn't matter, except we live most of our lives out there. If God's more here than out there, God's not in our lives that much. I find that troubling. Because I want more God in my life, right? You guys didn't all come here because you had nothing better to do. There's something of the divine we want. We want to explore it, wrestle it, have it communicate to us, have it influence us, do something for us. And this idea that God is more here than there is great on a Sunday morning. Right now, you're all here. Life is good. But what about tomorrow? Or the day after? I showed you two major iconoclasm movements. So you can see that we've struggled with this idea of putting God in a specific place and time for years. It's almost like we're wired to try and do that. And for the Reformation movement, for theological reasons, they moved icons out of our sphere, but that drive to have God here didn't seem to go away. And so it seems to me anyways, somehow we've made the church into the idol. We've made God here, in this place. Again, to me, if God's more here than there, and that's where I live my life, that's not good. So here's what I wanted you to do. Because I don't like that feeling. I want a God that's more there, is more everywhere. I want God that's everywhere in my life. So here, if you're open to this, here's what I'm trying. Pull out your phone, for those of you who have phones with you, and go to your alarm. If you have somebody with you, let them set the alarm. I want you to set an alarm for a couple times during this week. Just random times, any time during the week. Get your partner to send it for you because it'll be more funny because when you hear what I have you do. Just have it set an alarm that says God. And when the alarm goes off, here's what I want you to do. Whatever you're doing, I don't care if you're sitting on the John. I don't care if you're getting ready in the morning. I don't care if you're eating breakfast, having sex, going to work, finishing your emails. You stop. Yes, you stop. Even in the middle of sex. And you ask yourself, do I believe that God's in this moment, right here, as much as anywhere? And what would it look like if I believed God was here right now? Not in a judgmental way. Not in a, oh, I see what you're doing. You know, where we're like, that's not what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is fighting this idea that God is more here than there. Could we use this as a way to see God in our everyday lives? I don't know if that fits with your beliefs, but to me, as I started to explore this, things started to change for me. I'm looking at God in bizarre moments. And even though theologically I believe that God's as much there as it is here, I find myself subtly acting like it until I go, wait a second. Is this what I believe? Do I believe God's more here? Oh, I need to see God. I got to go to the church. I can't do it while I'm running. I can't do it while I'm doing the other things of my life. Would you be willing to try it? Because here's what I want you to imagine. Imagine God with you. The word Emmanuel means God with us. It's this idea that says God's with us everywhere. Again, not in the judgmental sense, but in the sense of loving you and being with you and knowing you in all parts of your life. Not hiding certain parts and then coming here and pretending to be different. If you drop a rock on your toe at home and you drop an F-bomb, drop it here. And then take God back there and have a God moment just there as much as you have it here. Isn't that an amazing concept? God with us everywhere. So let me end. May we see all of our lives bathed in God's presence. All of our lives. And may we feel loved throughout it. How does that sound? Because it sounds pretty good to me.